Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, Massimo, today we're going to dive into the world of fluffy thinking, by which we mean talk that sounds profound to a lot of people, but is actually, when you examine it a little more closely, wrong at best and nonsense at worst. So we're going to talk about what makes fluffy thinking fluffy, why does it appeal to so many people, and why do so many smart and educated people who should know better engage in it?
So I guess in some sense, I've been thinking about this topic as sort of counterbalance to a recent podcast that we've done. So recently we talked about how some rational skeptic or perhaps even hyper-rational skeptics, such as hardcore defenders of atheism and hardcore critics of religious thinking, perhaps overdo it in terms of overstretch the limits of rational thinking, and particularly in scientific thinking. This time we're going to sort of take a look at the opposite end of the spectrum, where we're going to take a look at what it is that makes some otherwise intelligent people say things that almost literally make no sense. And right, I'm not talking about the easy stuff, right? We're not talking about creationism or denial of or global warming or denial of the fact that there is no connection between vaccines and autism. We're not talking about simple pseudoscience, the kind of stuff that is factually clearly wrong, or at least that there is a lot of empirical evidence, and so we can talk about the evidence. We're talking about something much more, as you said, fluffy.
Right. So who do you think are the worst offenders?
Oh, boy.
I have my own picks. But
one of the worst offenders, I would have to say, it's a couple of physicists that I have several quotes from them that I'm going to bring up in the next few minutes. One is Freeman Dyson, and the other one is Paul Davis. They're both very smart guys. I mean, there's no question about the fact that these people
are... Okay, so there's no excuse.
Exactly. Makes it even worse. There's no excuse for it. So Freeman Dyson is a very well-known theoretical physicist. He's made major contributions to theoretical physics over the last several decades. Then later in his career, he started writing things that are more the borderline between science and religion. He won the Templeton Prize a few years ago, which, of course, in most people's books is not exactly a positive because, as most of our listeners probably know, the Templeton Foundation is this interesting outlet that gives out a prize that is now heftier than the Nobel to scientists who write something along the lines of for the scientific understanding of religion. This prize was set up by John Templeton to further a scientific understanding of religion, but the Templeton Foundation clearly has an agenda that is sort of pro-religion. Now, interestingly, in fact, both Dyson and Davis won the Templeton Prize, so there might be a connection here that
right.
might be worth exploring.
Well, I think what's so interesting about the group of people that are sort of the really prominent fluffy thinkers, the promoters of fluffy thinking, is that they...
Is there a fluffy thinkers website? I mean, maybe we should start one.
So some of them come from the world of either religion or mysticism and are trying to make what they say sound more scientific. And then some of them come from the world of science and are trying to make what they say sound more mystical. So there's this blurring of boundaries between science and mysticism, but it's coming from both ends.
That's right. I mean, it reminds me of the absolute worst offender of this genre, I think, is not a person, but is an alleged documentary, What the Bleep Do We Know, which came out a few years ago and which allegedly is an exploration of the relevance of quantum mechanics and neurobiology to issues of faith and spirituality and so on and so forth. And first of all, as we all know, as soon as you hear the word quantum mechanics, unless it is a physicist who is uttering the word, your baloney detector should go up at least to orange alert. But that movie, that documentary, which, by the way, is one of the largest grossing documentaries ever, and it's been followed then by a DVD series and called, I think, something like Down the Rabbit Hole. It's really bad stuff. I mean, you go through this thing, it's like more than a couple of hours, and initially it starts out with alleged scientists and alleged experts who talk about these things, and then the more you get into it, and the more you realize that they're talking about nothing in particular. It's just they're making up stuff as they go.
Right. So quantum theory is one of those scientific fields that seems to have spawned a whole lot of fluffy thinking. I mean, there have been scientific fields in the past that have been particularly ripe for the mining by New Age types and mystics, but quantum theory really, I mean, it's so weird and it's so mysterious. And So I think the thinking goes something like, hey, my idea is weird and mysterious too, ergo.
That's right. It's a gold mine. Exactly. Right. No, it is a gold mine. And I think that partly it is a gold mine because most people, as Richard Feynman usually famously said, and he knew what he was talking about when it came to quantum physics, he said, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you probably don't understand quantum mechanics. There really are very few people who are smart enough to cognizantly know and talk about these things. But the interesting thing about quantum mechanics, of course, is that although it is allegedly, or I wouldn't even say allegedly, it is definitely probably the most successful scientific theory ever produced.
In terms of the accuracy of its predictions, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Accuracy of predictions, in terms of, you know, the beauty of the mathematical results, the match between the mathematical results and empirical evidence. But still, we don't know what it means, because even quantum physicists don't really know what exactly it is in terms of physics that this stuff is telling us. So let alone people like Deepak Chopra, who claim that they have a quantum elixir of life and things of that sort.
Right. Well, Deepak Chopra is a really interesting case that I wanted to bring up, because I think he exemplifies a lot of the strands of fluffy thinking. But in particular, there's a strand that I think is the key to a lot of its appeal to people, and the reason that it works so well on people. And that's the deliberate use of ambiguity in so many of their statements, especially what I would call ambiguously metaphorical statements. So essentially you say something that could be either interpreted as a literal and really extraordinary claim or as a metaphor. And right. Deepak Chopra does this with quantum theory a lot. So he's published several best-selling books about how quantum mechanics, can alter your reality and heal your diseases. One of them is called Quantum Healing, which articulates this theory that a shift in consciousness causes a shift in biology. And so you might be forgiven for thinking that he is actually claiming that quantum mechanics somehow allows you to think your way to health, which would be pretty astonishing if it were true. But then I've seen him cornered in an interview and asked how exactly that works, by what mechanisms, and he says, oh, it's just a metaphor. Oh, this is a quote from Chopra. It's just a metaphor, just like an electron or a photon is an indivisible unit of information and energy. A thought is an indivisible unit of consciousness. And this was, by the way, in an interview with Richard Dawkins. And so Dawkins, he sounds generally surprised. Yeah, he says, oh, so you're just using it metaphorically. And then Chopra immediately reverts back to his original position and says, oh, no, I think quantum theory has a lot to say about observer effect. And so I think this is a great example. What this does, this sort of ambiguous metaphorical talk, is it allows the speaker to have it both ways.
That's right.
You can make these really extraordinary and sexy claims, and then if you're ever challenged, you can always fall back on, oh, well, I was speaking metaphorically.
Yes, which does sound a lot like sort of, again, mystical and religious talk of some sort, because again, you know, if you take the standard criticism of scriptures, for instance, right? If you say, well, do you really believe that the earth is 6,000 years old? And if you say yes, well, then you're easily dismissed as somebody who just doesn't understand geology, physics, and so on. But if you say no, and you say, well, then what do you mean? And well, it's a metaphor. It's a story.
Right.
All right. Well, if it is a metaphor and it's a story, then on the one hand, you're not actually telling me anything factually interesting. And on the other hand, you can pretty much interpret your metaphor or story however you like it, which means that, again, you're not really telling me anything interesting. Now, Deepak Chopra, of course, is, you know, it's an easy offender to highlight. But as I said, I want to go back for a minute to these physicists who are, you know, you really ought to know better. I mean, after all, Chopra is making money out of this, and he doesn't actually have credentials as a scientist. But these guys are serious scientists. And a couple of quotes that I'm going to bring up for this discussion are actually out of the transcripts of a recent episode of National Public Radio show, an outlet normally known for serious shows, with a few exceptions. One of the exceptions is Krista Tippett's Speaking of Faith, which unfortunately ruins all my Sunday mornings on NPR. And
it's
Tippett
like a, it's like a car crash, right? It's so terrible that you can't look away.
Right. And Tippett is, you know, one of those people who tries really hard, and I'm sure in very good faith, to reconcile, you know, science and religion, to find good stuff about mysticism and spiritualism and so on and so forth. And, you know, good for her. She's got a right to do that, of course. But she often goes into these sort of high-speed, fluffy thinking mode. And she's just, her latest book is just out, and it's called Einstein's God, where she once again picks up this idea that Einstein, in some sense or another, had some religious belief, which is highly questionable.
See, I think Einstein was speaking metaphorically when he talked about God, or figuratively.
I think it's true. I think that's clearly the case. But
actually, sorry, if I can just interject quick. This reminds me that another reason I think that this this ambiguous metaphorical talk by the fluffy thinkers works so well is that science does speak metaphorically a lot of the time. I mean, it's a really useful way to talk about really abstract or complicated processes. So scientists will say things like, nature abhors a vacuum, or this gene wants you to procreate. It's just such a natural way to talk about these things. And so maybe people get used to that kind of language.
And then
when they hear it, they sort of forget on some level that these metaphors are only legitimate if they're referring to actual scientific processes. Then it sounds legit to them in the context of...
Well, Richard Dawkins sold a lot of books, but also got into a lot of trouble for entirely one of his, you know, his most, arguably his most famous book, The Selfish Gene. It's a metaphor. I mean, he never meant it as anything other than a metaphor, but he got in a lot of trouble, and I think actually rightly so, because, you know, you got to be careful. When you use a metaphor, there are some implications, especially if you're talking not to other scientists, but to the general public. So let me bring up a couple of quotes from a transcript from Krista Tippett's show, where she had, in order to launch her book, she had both Paul Davies and Freeman Dyson. And so, for instance, at some point, Freeman Dyson said, and this is a direct quote, "Science is full of mysteries. Every time we discover something, we find two more questions to ask, and so that there is no end of mysteries in science. That's what it's all about, and the same is true for religion." Unquote. Now, first of all, this idea that every time we find an answer, there is two questions, that's completely made up of thin air. I mean, that's clearly not the case. Sometimes you get an answer and that's it. That's the end of the road.
Right.
Sometimes you get an answer and there's 10 more questions that are brought up. But I'm not going to quibble too much on that quote. Clearly, he didn't mean it literally. He hadn't done actually the calculations of how many new questions arise from every answer. The part that bothers me is the last one, where he says, and that is the same for religion. Really? When was the last time that religion actually answered a question to begin with? And what are the additional questions that come out of a typical religious answer? To say that when a scientist, especially a scientist of that caliber, says that, you know, that is the same as for religion, by making a direct parallel between science, which is by far the most successful enterprise that human beings have ever devised to discover things about human nature, and religion, which is by far the most unsuccessful enterprise that human beings have devised to find out things about nature, and in fact, which allegedly is not really about finding things about nature, that puzzles me. You know, why would you say that other than because you're being nice to Krista Tippett?
Right. That reminds me of another tactic that people use to make science sound more like mysticism, which is, or to create this sort of false equivalency between science and mysticism. Paul Davies, in a New York Times opinion piece a couple years ago, said that science proceeds on faith, essentially, the faith that there are these ordered laws in nature. But he says, you know, where do these laws come from and why do they have the form that they do? Scientists don't know. And clearly, he says, both religion and science are founded on faith, namely on belief in the existence of something outside the universe, like an unexplained God or an unexplained set of physical laws. See how he slipped that in there? They're really equivalent. It's just faith.
That is the kind of thing that really raises my blood pressure to an uncomfortably unhealthy level. I mean, why would you say something like that? First of all, it's definitely not true. Right? So science is not based on anything like faith. It is based on assumptions. Some of these assumptions can actually be tested, And other assumptions are simply reasonable based on what we know about the world. So let's talk about, for instance, you know, natural laws, the existence of natural laws. There's a lot of discussions in philosophy actually about what exactly is a natural law. But one reasonable way to think about it is that a natural law is simply a regularity in the behavior of the universe for which we've never seen an exception. Okay. Now, great. Do we have faith in natural laws? No. What we have is a large, very, very large number of observations that confirm the fact that what we thought so far is natural laws, let's say the law of gravity, keeps in fact working. And guess what? Should one of these days the law of gravity not work anymore, I don't think that any scientist would say, well, no, I'm just going to keep going on and march forward as if we still had a law of gravity. No, the scientist would in fact not act at all as a person of faith. He would say, oh, darn, the law of gravity changed. Now we got to change our way of thinking about it.
So I think we should probably try to explain why this kind of thinking happens now that we've sort of established what it is and the tricks that it uses. And I think the Davies and Dyson quotes are really good examples of one explanation that I find plausible and that a couple of our commenters brought up. Let me quote one named John Drager, who says, I think the main answer as to why such people use fluffy language and vacuous arguments is that they're trying to rationalize an irrational belief. They've accepted the conclusion that God or spirits or souls exist, and then they're just trying to find a compelling argument to support that belief. And this is actually really similar to the point that Michael Shermer makes in his article, Why Do Smart People Believe Weird Things? His answer is smart people are particularly good at defending beliefs, at coming up with elaborate rationalizations for beliefs that they arrived at for non-smart reasons. So you really do have to, if you're going to try to defend something completely false or unsupported, and you're going to try to do it in an intellectual sounding way, you really do have to tie yourself into really elaborate knots.
Now that's an excellent point. And by the way, of course, we shouldn't we should dispel immediately one possible objection about what we're saying, which is the two of us are certainly not exceptions. Smart people in general, in fact, people in general, we know from neurobiological research, are very good at rationalizing beliefs. And as Michael Shermer pointed out, smart people are particularly good at rationalizing beliefs because that's what it means to be smart. And you find interesting ways of sort of reconciling your views of the world with the fact. So what is therefore the point of criticizing somebody else's fluffy thinking? The point is that in an open society, we learn from each other precisely because other smart people will criticize what we say. I have no doubt that I am perfectly capable of going to live on a deserted island, for instance, and rationalize all sorts of things and come up with a completely bizarre view of the world that I would be completely convinced is true. The reason that doesn't happen is because I open myself as much as possible to criticism by a bunch of people, including the readers of our blog that, as you know, are particularly vociferous whenever we write something. And that's how the dialogue works. So the point that I'm trying to make is that this is not just about ranting about fluffy thinking, and it's not about picking on Paul Davies or whoever else, or Krista Tippett, and so on. It's about the idea that critical thinking and therefore criticism of other people's reasoning is the only way that can get you out of rationalizing, because if you're left to your own devices, everybody does it, including ourselves.
Right. Oh, another commenter had a theory that I liked a lot, which is that there might be a natural selection bias in favor of fluffy thinking. A commenter named Tea Time pointed out that bad ideas stated clearly are easy targets to decimate, but bad ideas camouflaged in fluffiness are harder to spot, so they can survive to the next generation and perpetuate themselves.
That's actually a good point. Of course, we do have examples of really bad ideas that are easy to debunk, and they're still around, like, say, astrology, for instance. But I think that's a good point. That the more the idea is couched in fuzzy terms and in terms that are difficult to pin down, it becomes difficult to actually mount a reasonable criticism. This is true in other areas as well. If our listeners go to our blog, they'll see several entries scattered here and there on postmodernism, for instance. You've written about it, and I've written about it.
Yeah.
And that there is the same problem there, that a lot of postmodernist philosophical, or I would say pseudo-philosophical pronouncements, fall into one of two categories, which are very similar to the ones that you brought up at the beginning of this podcast, which is either the pronouncement sounds deep, but in fact is completely mistaken, or sounds deep, and in fact, it is completely superficial.
Yeah, actually, we should probably mention that there's a word for this, which was popularized by Dan Dennett. It's called a deepity.
Yes, I love that word. You want to explain what it is?
It's a great word, yeah. So he mentioned it in a lecture a couple years ago, and he defined it as a proposition that seems to be profound because it is actually logically ill-formed. So it has at least two readings, and it balances precariously between them. On one reading, it's true but trivial, and on another reading, it's false but would be earth-shattering if true.
That's
so
right.
This actually leads into another tactic, which fluffy thinkers use either intentionally or unintentionally. So the example that Dan Dennett gave was the phrase, love is just a word.
Ah.
And so he said, okay, yes, on one level, this is true. Literally,
that's
love.
Trivially true, right.
Right, like the word love is just a word. It has four letters. It begins with an L. That's really not all that earth-shattering, just like the word cow is just a word. Yep. On another level, if you remove the quotes and say love, the phenomenon, I mean, people mean different things about it, as I've blogged about, but they're referring to some kind of feeling or emotion or state, and that's not the same as a word. It's a feeling, not a word, so that's not true.
That's
and so this,
obviously not true, right.
Right, so I'm often accused of not giving philosophers enough credit, but there is an argument that philosophers, or a fallacy that philosophers have pointed out, and that's the use-mention distinction.
Right.
So this is, I think this is at the core of a lot of fluffy thinking, which is confusing a concept with the word describing that concept. So this happens a lot with talk about God. There's a book that came out a year or two ago by Robert Wright called The Evolution of God. And it's not about that. It's about the evolution of the concept of God and people's ideas about God. It's not actually about the evolution of God himself.
Right.
And this
right.
comes up a lot.
Yeah. And actually, I'm glad that you struck a good one for philosophers. And there is a good reason for that, because, in fact, philosophy at its best, you know, at its worst, it can really be damaging fluffy thinking itself. As we mentioned earlier, there's a lot of, although not all, postmodernist or deconstructive thinking and writing that is really bad stuff, and a perfectly good example of fluffy thinking or obscure thinking. But at its best, that is one of the major things that philosophy is supposed to do, to analyze what we say, to analyze the concepts, and to, you know, as philosophers often say, to unpack our concepts and look what it's inside. And sometimes you don't find anything inside, and then you have exposed some fluffy thinking.
Right. So to wrap up, because we're quickly running out of time, I'd like to just refer back to the Deepak Chopra interview with Dawkins that I mentioned earlier, because this is illustrative of one of my biggest pet peeves in fluffy thinking, which is redefining words to mean whatever you want and co-opting words from science to mean something completely different. Words like wave or energy or uncertainty, that's like crack to the fluffy thinker. And so Deepak Chopra uses this word quantum, which he tosses around and pretends that it means something else. And what was most striking about this interview is that he actually accused quantum physicists of co-opting the word quantum. So he says, the aficionados in the world of quantum physics have somehow hijacked the word for their own use, which, I mean, Dawkins is a pretty unflappable guy, but he was pretty flapped. He said, oh, so they've hijacked your word for their own use. Deepak Chopra said yes.
That's right. And now I have another example, actually, before we close, because it's one of my favorite. I don't remember the author of this, but it is a physicist, actually, a fairly well-known physicist, as well as an Anglican priest or minister, I should say. And at one point, he presented this serious paper where he said that there is a deep analogy between a religious text, in particular the New Testament, and quantum mechanics, because you see, light has a dual nature, particle and wave, which is just like the dual nature of Jesus, divine and human.
And oh, so when deep.
Exactly, it sounds very deep, right? And then you say, wait a minute, what do you mean just like? Do you mean that Jesus is a photon? And what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. It just sounds very deep, and it sounds very comforting to people, as you mentioned earlier, who want at all costs to reconcile their religious beliefs, to which, of course, they're entitled. I mean, you know, we're all entitled to believe whatever we believe, as long as we don't club other people to death if they don't have that kind of belief, the same belief. But so this is not about having a right to believe in one thing or another. It is about, you know, if you actually want to justify that belief rationally, then you open yourself to rational criticism. You know, as you know, I've debated creationists quite a bit. And one of the interesting things that happened with creationists often, not always, but often, is that you get into this debate. It goes on for hours and hours, especially if it is a one-on-one, not in public, but, you know, on a sort of personal, on a personal level. And at some point or another, they would say, okay, well, you got some good arguments. I'll have to think about it. But, you know, I have faith. And as soon as they put out this trump card, my response is, okay, but that's unfair because you just changed the rules of the game. Until a minute ago, we were in the same box, in the same ring, playing by the same rules. You were arguing one way, I was arguing another way. We were using the rules of logic and evidence. As soon as I trumped your logic and evidence, you jumped out of the ring and you said, nope, sorry, I still believe. All right, you can do that. But now you have to at least admit that you're not using rational thinking.
Massimo, every time you bring up another egregious example, I just want to vent about 10 more. So I'm going to have to cut us both off right now.
Sounds good.
We're going to move on to the rationally speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julia and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is a book that came out last year, so I'm a little late to the party, but it's by R. Crumb, who's a famous underground cartoonist. Well, he's famous now, but he started out as a real sort of underground counterculture type, and it's called The Illustrated Book of Genesis. So he literally illustrated the entire book of Genesis. Every word is in there. And there was a lot of hype surrounding this book before it came out because he's known to be so counterculture and he's not religious at all. And his stuff is really pretty subversive. So people were expecting basically a subversion of the Bible. And it's not that. It's actually, he played it surprisingly straight. He really illustrates everything that happens in Genesis pretty much earnestly. And it's actually a pleasure to read. The R. Crumb style is famously fleshy and earthy and hairy, and it really humanizes the stories. And I think as a non-theist, it's easy to just dismiss the Bible and not pay any attention to it. And as a Christian, I would imagine anyway, that these stories would become so familiar and so canon that you stop really thinking about them. And so what's interesting about R. Crumb's take on Genesis is that he sort of treats it as a historical text, as an interesting window into what life would have been like for these people and what the mindset of living in this time would be like. And the illustrations help flesh out some of the more interesting details that are hidden but not obvious in the stories, like in the story where Joseph is thrown into the pit by his brothers. The story just says, and he was thrown into the pit and there was no water in the pit. But then in the illustration, you can actually see his grief and it's really moving. And then in the story in which, and in the later part of the story in which his brothers reunite with him, the story says they don't recognize him, and it's not really clear why that is. But with R. Crumb's illustration, you can see that that's because now he's dressed as an Egyptian nobleman, and so that's why they don't recognize him. So really, it really makes these stories more realistic. Although I do have to quibble with basically the liner notes. Essentially, R. Crumb wrote this essay trying to analyze the story of Genesis and put it in historical context.
Oh boy, that sounds like trouble.
It kind of is. It's not pseudoscience, it's pseudo-history, I would have to say. So he has this whole theory about how he tries to interpret Genesis in terms of the end of matriarchal societies in Egypt and Mesopotamia and the rise of patriarchal societies. And when I read this, it took me aback because I didn't know there were matriarchal societies. And so I spent forever Googling around trying to figure out where he got that from. And there's like this one source by this very discredited scholar arguing that there were these matriarchal societies in Egypt and Mesopotamia around this time. And so R. Crumb takes that idea and just runs with it. And it makes no sense.
Well,
but
the
book is really enjoyable.
The best commentary I've ever read about the Bible actually was by Isaac Asimov, obviously written years ago since he's been dead for a while. But that's not my pick. My
What's
pick
your
for
pick,
today is it's from a website called rationalwiki.com. In particular, if you go to that website and you search for the omnipotence paradox, there's a nice little entry about one of those little intellectual puzzles that I think is very interesting and might have consequences for your way of looking at the world. So the omnipotence paradox, which I just happened very recently by chance to actually teach in one of my philosophy classes, is this. It comes in a variety of examples, but the typical example is, and I'm quoting from the website, which is in turn quoting from Homer Simpson, that clearly the clear giant of philosophy. The quote is, could Jesus microwave a burrito so hot that he himself could not eat it? And that is a funny take on it, but that is in fact the essence of the paradox. That is, the idea is, well, if God is in fact omnipotent, can God do something that he cannot undo? And it comes in, you know, the idea comes in a variety of particular examples. You know, could God make a mountain that he cannot move? Could he make a stone that he cannot move? And so on and so forth.
Or I like
in the
burrito.
Case, yeah, in the case of the burrito, I like the burrito. And the idea is this, that, of course, if you answer, yes, he can, then what that means is that God is, in fact, capable of doing something that he cannot then undo, which seems to pose some limits to his omnipotence. But if you answer no, he cannot make something that he cannot undo, that also clearly seems to be posing a problem for his, for the idea of omnipotence. So either way you answer the question, it would seem that God cannot possibly be omnipotent. Since this is a logical puzzle, not a matter of factual information, we're not measuring the degree of omnipotence of God, obviously. This is not an empirical matter. It's a logical problem. And if it is a logical problem, typically when you run into paradoxes, one of the possibilities, the very good possibilities, is that the concept itself that generates the paradox is in fact intrinsically incoherent. So right. This may point out to the possibility that the whole idea of omnipotence, which, as you know, is pretty widespread among religious believers, is in fact incoherent. It is not logical. If that should be the case, then it would follow that there cannot possibly be such a thing as an omnipotent God, which, of course, it has all sorts of interesting theological consequences.
Interesting.
So that's my pick for this episode.
Are there going to be any other examples of you actually resolving a paradox in favor of the theists, Massimo? Are you setting a precedent with this?
We're setting a precedent, yes. we'll see what happens.
Interesting. Okay, this has been another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.